This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota. And today we're going to start our show down south in the United States. We're going to talk with Connor Town O'Neill. He is the author of a new book, Down with That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. And he joins us from the campus, right, Connor? Aren't you an instructor now?
That's right. Yeah, I teach at Auburn University.
So you're in Auburn, Alabama, generally, I take it, unless you're teaching online.
A little bit of both. Yeah, it's been a strange semester.
Well, let's talk about this book. Why did you write it?
Yeah, this book I've been working on for about 5 years now. And it's I first came across this story back in March of 2015 during the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. That was the attack by Alabama law enforcement on nonviolent demonstrators on Selma's Edmund Pettus Bridge, a real sort of flashpoint of the civil rights movement. The late John Lewis was among those leading the march. And so on the 50th anniversary, President Obama was in town to cross over the bridge in remembrance and to give a speech. 48,000 other people showed up. And so, you know, Selma, which is a pretty small city in Alabama, was suddenly just, you know, flooded with people. And so I was there to report on the anniversary, and you needed to find some parking. And so I figured that maybe I'd pull out off into this cemetery that's near downtown Selma. And it's one of those southern cemeteries, think Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, you know, Spanish moss, mausoleums, you know, a cemetery so big it has its own system of roads. So I thought, yeah, I'll stash my car there and I can walk down to the bridge. But I ended up finding way more than I bargained for. I ended up meeting a group of people there who call themselves the Friends of Forest. They're this neo-Confederate group who have a circle in the cemetery in which they have markers for the Confederate dead, and also a bust of this Civil War general, Nathan Bedford Forrest. And the dissonance of that encounter, meeting these neo-Confederates on a day of this major civil rights anniversary, it really just gave me whiplash. And so in the months afterwards, I started asking all of these questions. Who was Nathan Bedford Forrest? What did it mean to put up a Confederate monument in the year 2015? And so I had started some initial investigation to those questions when, just a few months later, the Charleston 9 murders happened. And after Dylann Roof was arrested, some images from his blog began to circulate, and it became clear that in advance of going to Charleston, where he murdered 9 parishioners at Emmanuel AME Church, he had gone on this sort of sightseeing tour across South Carolina, visiting Confederate markers and moments of Confederate history, and also plantations, and as if to kind of steel himself for this act of racial terrorism that he was about to commit. And so in the wake of that attack, Confederate monuments, the flag, symbols of the Confederacy, you know, across the South really came under fire. And so because of this strange encounter that I had had with the Friends of Forrest just a few months earlier, I decided that I was going to follow some of these campaigns aimed at Forrest in particular. And so the book talks about this battle in Selma that sort of prefigured a lot of the debates that we've had in the years since, and then looks at 3 other cities in which there are monuments of Forrest. And I speak with activists who are trying to get those monuments down and defenders of Forrest who are working to keep them up. And so it becomes a sort of travelogue or dispatches from, you know, the Civil War that just, you know, seems to be unending.
Well, Nathan Bedford Forrest was a general. He actually started as a private during the Civil War and ascended to a generalship. So he obviously was considered very good at fighting wars. But he was also a slave trader. And after the Civil War, he was closely aligned with what became the Ku Klux Klan. So this is somebody of real import in terms of this legacy that we're talking about. What is the significance of Selma, Alabama, beyond that bridge and with Nathan Bedford Forrest?
Selma was then also one of the site for one of the last battles in the Civil War in April of 1865, and Forrest was the Confederate commander for that battle. So he's remembered at least by some in Selma as the defender of Selma. The monument that the Friends of Forrest put up lists that as one of his nicknames on the pedestal of the monument that they put up in 2000. And that date just goes to show that he is continues to be sort of present, at least symbolically, in Selma long after the Civil War ended.
There are some fascinating footnotes in your book, and this is Connor Towne O'Neill, the author of Down with That Devil's Bones, which focuses on one of the principal figures of the Confederacy, Nathan Bedford Forrest, and that is the connection between Mary Todd Lincoln and Elodie Todd Dawson. I had never heard this before.
That's right. Yeah, they were half sisters, and Mary wound up with that ambitious lawyer from Illinois, Abraham Lincoln, whereas her half sister Elodie married Nathaniel Dawson, who was a Southerner from Alabama. They actually met at Jefferson Davis's inauguration ball as the president of the Confederacy. They exchanged letters throughout the war. And after the war, Elodie Todd Dawson became a real leader in what would go on to be known as the United Daughters of the Confederacy, and advocating for the lost cause way of viewing the war, which was meant to commemorate the war not as a war fought to protect and expand slavery, which if you look at the documents of secession, if you look at speeches from Jefferson Davis, that was clearly the project of the Confederacy, and they were splitting no hairs about it. They were being direct and would tell anyone who listened that's why they were fighting this war. But that proved to be inconvenient after the war, after hundreds of thousands of people had died for a cause to perpetuate slavery. So the lost cause is an ideology meant to sort of sidestep those thornier questions of what the war was about and what it meant. And so they meant there's this project to memorialize the bravery of the Southern soldier and to mourn the dead, but also to spread a history that painted slavery as a relatively benign system in which there were, contented slaves and benevolent masters. I mean, really fictions, but convenient fictions that sort of let white Southerners off the hook after the war. And Elodie Todd Dawson was a leader of that in Selma, and she worked to establish a Confederate Memorial Circle, this place in the cemetery that some 150 years later, I would have this pivotal meeting with the Friends of Forrest.
Now, Nathan Bedford Forrest was a hero of the Confederacy, but it isn't until the early 20th century that he sort of becomes famous worldwide, because D.W. Griffith produces this, at the time, landmark silent movie called Birth of a Nation. How is it that Forrest became such an icon of white supremacy?
He became such an icon of white supremacy because he is present in so many moments of racial reckoning. Really, he was a big slave trader before the war. He was this fearsome sort of intuitive general during the war, including overseeing the massacre of black soldiers at Fort Pillow toward the end of the war. And then, of course, after the war, serving as the first Grand Wizard of the Klan, he is present at all these real sort of touch points of white supremacy in the Civil War era. And of course, as the figurehead of the Klan, he is responsible for undermining and overthrowing Reconstruction. This brief moment after the war, where it seemed like we were pursuing a system of government in which we really could move from a slave society to a multiracial democracy, where the formerly enslaved Black Americans could be, vested with political rights, with voting rights, protected under the law in the same way that white Americans were. And of course, that was fought tooth and nail by former Confederates such as Nathan Bedford Forrest, and so movies like Birth of a Nation look at the Klan's overthrow of Reconstruction as something admirable because it meant their return to power. And now, of course, that movie is historically, from a historical perspective, nonsense. It's again a part of this lost cause thinking that falsely regards Black leadership as inept, and Black men as lascivious. All these sort of fictions that are meant to dehumanize Black Americans after the war. But the flip side of that is to honor men like Forrest, who so gallantly protected this Southern way of life that is, of course, built on the bedrock of white supremacy.
Well, this is the Civil War monument conundrum. You got monuments of the losing leaders of that war, the Confederacy, and they were, I think, by most definitions, traitors. And yet, across the South, there are Confederate monuments outside so many Southern courthouses on so many Southern campuses, including the University of Alabama, your alma mater. So it's part of the landscape. You can't miss it.
That's right. Yeah, they're ubiquitous. When I spoke to Madison Smart Bell, a novelist who wrote a great novel about Forrest called Devil's Dream, he told me that growing up in Middle Tennessee, Forrest was just sort of the water that you swam in. And I think that's true across the South. Like you say, the lawn of every courthouse has a Confederate monument on it. I think what's important to note is that even though the Confederacy lost the military battles, the ideology that the Confederacy was fighting to uphold long outlived the 4 years of Civil War. You know, Lincoln promised that every drop brought by the lash would be repaid by the sword, meaning that the costs, that the debts racked up by this system of slavery in which, you know, white Americans North and South were enriching themselves would be rectified, would be addressed. But really, after Reconstruction was overthrown and undermined, that really wasn't the case. So while the South lost the military war, in a lot of ways, it won the ideological war. That's why the losers, as it were, these traitors, are able to erect monuments to their heroes because they had returned to power. And there wasn't that deeper reckoning. The central question of the war about whether we really could become a multiracial democracy and get past the system of slavery and the ideology of Black inferiority that it was built on didn't happen. And so we have these reminders in every courthouse that the ideology of the Confederacy persists.
Well, you follow Nathan Bedford Forrest all across the South. You start in Selma, then you go to Murfreesboro, Tennessee, because that's Middle Tennessee State University, and there's a Forrest Hall there. It's the ROTC building, but that becomes a big issue with students there during the 21st century. Then you go to Memphis, or Nashville, I should say, where there's a very strange monument to Nathan Bedford Forrest, and then Memphis, where he actually had his slave market became extremely wealthy before the Civil War, and of course was fighting to retain slavery as a general during that war. This is hopscotching around the South and seeing this same person venerated.
That's right. And what's interesting is that these statues go up at very different moments in history. I think defenders of these Confederate monuments sometimes like to argue that to take down a statue is to destroy our history. But that's not really true. I mean, if that were true, pages of my book would be vanishing into thin air every week throughout the summer. The history resides in the historical record, in our archives, in our documents. Monuments are about honor, and are about the time that they go up, and about moments in which they're challenged, just as much as they are about the history that they seek to venerate. So, for example, the statue in Memphis, this 30-foot bronze equestrian statue in a downtown park in Memphis, goes up in 1905. So that's, decades after the Civil War, after former Confederates had returned to power, are imposing Jim Crow laws, and specifically in Memphis, this is in the aftermath of Ida B. Wells's investigative reporting on the nature of racial terror lynchings. And I think there's a way of reading that statue going up as a rebuke to those challenges embodied by the work of Ida B. Wells. So it's about a figure from the Civil War, but that statue going up speaks to its moment, just as much as it does to any history that it seeks to engage with. The Forest Hall at Middle Tennessee State University is christened with that name in the years after the Brown v. Board decision, striking down school segregation, but years before that school would actually integrate. So again, it's calling to the Civil War, but it's calling to the Civil War and to the Confederacy from a particular moment, and that moment is very telling. And then again, of course, in Selma, that statue of Forrest, the one that set me on this journey, that statue had originally gone up in the year 2000, so this is a century and a half after the Civil War. But it went up the week after the city's first black mayor had been inaugurated. So again, these are historical monuments, but they say just as much about the time that they go up and reflect the views and the power that people in the present hold. So I'm looking at these different battles over these monuments as a way of looking at the present, just as much as I am to look at the past.
These monuments are inextricably linked to politics, and that's the case now. Back during the civil rights period in the mid-60s and into the 70s, George Wallace was a famous governor of Alabama and a segregationist, and he was currying votes by literally trumpeting white supremacy. And we still see it today. We see candidates' flags and Confederate flags at the same gatherings.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. They're because they stage a tension, a question that is still with us. We're still a country riven by racial inequity. The racial wealth gap in this country is 10 to 1. The coronavirus pandemic has exposed the inequities in healthcare access that breaks down on a on the basis of race. Opportunities, wealth, education. Access to food, access to living in parts of cities that aren't Superfund sites, all in all of these different ways, we're still a country that is riven by racial inequity, and so these moments of racial reckoning from the past are going to continue to stay with us, and we're going to continue to keep fighting these battles because we haven't yet figured out how to really achieve the country, as James Baldwin put it, to really live up to the ideals of freedom that for so long we've claimed. And I think we're in one of those moments now. The Civil War and Reconstruction really challenged us to be a different way and to literally reconstruct the country along different lines. And we turned away from that. The Civil Rights Movement, 100 years later, did the same thing, and we turned away from that again, moving to presidential candidates who purport to be about law and order, relying on systems like mass incarceration or the war on drugs. And I think we're in one of those moments now. Another law and order presidential candidate who has a clear record of wanting to support, white grievance over, providing dignity, safety, care, opportunity for people of color in this country.
You mentioned the issue that is still around and, of course, was It's been white hot since the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis at the hands of Minneapolis police. And I think shortly after that, Mississippi reviewed its controversial flag, which had the Confederate battle flag kind of incorporated into it. And now they're going to have a new flag. And the Alabama state flag, if you look at that, it's described as the Crimson Cross of St. Andrew across a field of white. But my goodness, it looks like something else if you're just glancing at it. So there is sort of another look. It's a sort of another civil rights moment that we're in that seems to pop up every now and then, and yet the issue simply won't go away.
Yeah, and I think these moments, we're in a moment where we, as you point out, we are having a real referendum on our symbols and what these symbols say and who they seek to honor and who they seek to ignore or to demean or dehumanize. And I think those moments are important. I mean, following these sorts of symbolic battles have proved to be incredibly powerful for me. They have. Been the lens through which I've come to understand so much about this country and the problems of inequity that we're wrestling with. And so I hope that can be the case too, that these symbolic protests can be flashpoints that pull people deeper into looking at why these symbols are still there. What are the systems of power that keep them there? What are the other systems that are making the American inequalities linger and persist? And so I hope that they can galvanize support for the harder and longer battles that we've still got to face to make this country more equal.
Connor Towne O'Neill is the author of Down With That Devil's Bones. How did that title come to be, That Devil's Bones?
Yeah, it's a good question. I've always been a fan of long titles, and reporting these stories in four cities meant a lot of car time. And if you're like me, you find yourself falling into these strange sort of fugue states during long late night drives. And so the title is a combination of a couple of ideas that I was thinking through while reporting this story. That Devil, of course, is a moniker given to Forrest by the Union General, William Tecumseh Sherman, who referred to Forrest as that devil. And said that, Forrest needed to be stopped at any cost, even if it bankrupted the treasury. So that was one of his monikers, that devil, which I think is evocative and as a sort of useful name for a villain of American history. And while covering the Middle Tennessee State campaign to change the name of Forrest Hall, looking into the history of that school, it became clear that throughout the decades, students had been protesting that name and trying to get the school to shed its Confederate symbols. And at one point, a student in the 60s wrote an op-ed to the school paper saying that the school should have the good sense to let Forrest's mistakes stay buried along with his bones. So it's a sort of mashup of a couple of different ideas that were floating in my head while reporting this story and during one of those late night car rides that just kind of congealed together. And it has a sort of poetic nature to it that maybe eludes explanation. But there you go.
The book is Down With That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. The author is Connor Towne O'Neill. Connor, thanks for spending time with us today.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much. Good to be with you.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Coming up on Main Street, October 12th is Native American Day. We'll share a profile of a prominent North Dakotan. And horticulturist Ron Smith will join us for some fall lawn and garden talk. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Questions still surround what will happen in Legislative District 8 with the death of one of its candidates. The Secretary of State, Al Jaeger, has asked for an Attorney General's opinion. One of the Republican candidates for the State House of Representatives position, David Ondal, passed away suddenly. Absentee voting had already begun, and Ondal's name remains on the ballot. Jaeger says he had an understanding of what the law said, but a number of questions had been raised. His letter to Attorney General Wayne Stengem asked three specific questions.
One, what will be the result or effect of the votes cast for the deceased candidate? And if the deceased candidate receives a number of votes that would be sufficient to elect the candidate, may the candidate be declared to have been elected? And if so, would a vacancy then exist? And if that answer is affirmative, well then, if the vacancy does exist, what would be the process for filling the vacant position?
Jaeger says if it is declared that Ondal won the seat and a vacancy exists, the GOP District Party's Executive Committee would choose a successor. Jaeger says he expects to have the opinion within a week. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is projecting farm income will increase by 23% this year. As Harvest Public Media's Jonathan All reports, that's only because of an unprecedented amount of government payouts.
Federal subsidies to farmers to make up for coronavirus losses could top $40 billion. Without that money, farmers would be seeing a decrease of about 6% of their income this year. Pat Westhoff is an agricultural economist at the University of Missouri. He says the report is short-term good news because farmers have more money in their pockets right now.
However, looking forward, there's a real concern of what happens next. You know, so if this proves to be the last round of these emergency payments, be a pretty steep table people are going to drop off of next year.
Westhoff says corn and soybean prices are rising faster than expected, which will help next year's outlook. The other good news from the report is that the cost of farming is down 1% this year. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
And North Dakota Senator Kevin Cramer says a new economic stimulus package will likely not happen until after the election. Appearing on CNBC's Squawk Box, Cramer said there is a continued impasse between the White House and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi over what should be in that stimulus bill. And he says Republicans have been concerned about adding to the country's debt.
Once that election pressure valve is released, then I think there's all kinds of opportunity to get something done. I think people ought to be optimistic about that. But that's not really the kind of message we ought to be sending as lawmakers.
Cramer says Senate Republicans are more on board with targeted relief, while House Democratic leaders are pushing for an all or nothing bill. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. October 12th is a significant date on the calendar. For many years, it was Columbus Day. Now it's more often referred to as Indigenous Peoples Day and Native American Day. Usually around this time of year, we share features about new inductees into the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor. This year, because of the pandemic, there will be no inductees, so we will return to 2016, the Hall of Honor's first year, to share a feature on one of the first inductees, Marcellus Red Tomahawk. You'll hear the voices of LaDonna Allard, Standing Rock Sioux tribal historian, and his great-grandsons, Pete and Wilbur Red Tomahawk.
I think that we have to remember people like Marcellus Red Tomahawk because they had insight to say, yes, we have to figure out how to work with this new system. We have to find a balance. But we have to remain who we are. We have to protect our land. We have to protect our water and our way of life. I find these people at the beginning amazing people because it's through them that we still have everything we have. Their forethought, the ideal of thinking about the seventh generation and the people to come that are not born.
What he did was he advocated for school, education. He wanted children to go to school. And there was no school back then. And it was only our language. So by having the schools in all the districts, I believe that education was a very important tool, very important issue dealing with our grandfather.
Well, from my perspective, Marcellus Red Tomahawk was something that was kind of the negative when I was growing up. You know, they focused on his involvement in the arrest of Sitting Bull. And that's the negativity that I've received throughout the years of my young life. But when people open your eyes, then you can see all the accomplishments and all the notorieties that he had in his life. You know, I seen some pictures where he met royalty in Mandan. And then to see him standing on the steps of the Capitol in Washington, D.C. You look at what he did in his lifetime. One, he advocated for education. Two, he was law enforcement. The third thing is leadership. That in itself is an accomplishment. To have your peers, to have the people that you represent say that you're the leader is quite an accomplishment. Leadership is probably at the top of the list.
And then to be honored by the state of North Dakota, to have his image on the state patrol cars and signs.
He's been giving directions going north, south, east, west, to all the residents of our great state of North Dakota for almost 100 years.
Marcellus Red Tomock is an amazing person to be inducted into the Native American Hall of Honor for being the first tribal chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, to be one of the first people in saying the Black Hills are ours and protecting the Black Hills, for the person who is protecting the land, the water, and our people so that we still have these components today, for a person who sat down and wrote the first tribal constitution when tribal constitutions weren't in existence. To me, these are amazing things.
Marcellus Red Tomahawk died in 1931. His profile was produced by Makoche Studios in Bismarck for the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor. You can see all of the profiles online at statemuseum.nd.gov. Horticulturist Ron Smith is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
When you take that social distancing walk or do chores around the house, I mean, you've got plenty of time for that, right? Put on your earbuds and immerse yourself in public radio content made just for you.
Hey, y'all, it's Sam Sanders, and welcome to NPR One.
Hourly newscasts from NPR and Prairie Public, your favorite podcasts, and your new favorite podcast. Plus, stories from Planet Money and Hidden Brain, coverage of the arts, and something we really need to be paying attention to these days, health and science. NPR One is personalized public radio content tailored to your interests, but you'll also hear up-to-the-minute news you need to know, like on the coronavirus.
That personalized balance is the heart and soul of NPR One.
It's just like the radio, but under your control. Download the NPR One app and listen.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and because it's still a little bit green out there, it's time to talk with horticulturist Ron Smith.
Ron, thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here. It's a beautiful day to be talking about this, and then right after we're done, to get outside and get some work done in your yard. The biggest thing we see out there are the leaves all over our lawn. The wind that we had yesterday helped to bring down a lot of the remaining leaves, but there's still quite a few on the deciduous trees, at least in my neighborhood here. So there's going to be more leaves to come probably for the rest of the month. But there's a lot of other things that we can go ahead and do. And I would like to encourage the listeners to consider October, late September, not early October, but the entire month of October to do landscaping. Landscaping with leaf plants, perennial plants, or moving those plants from one spot to another. It would be more favorable for their growth and for your enjoyment of looking at them. So this is the time of the year that we need to try to get a new habit started with the American mind, especially up here in North Dakota where we have such long winters. So if we can get out and take a look, not so much at the big box stores because they're pretty well sold out, but if you have local garden centers, I know they have some good nursery stock there that they would love to sell you. And many times they're at a bargain price 30% off, 50% off, whatever it might be, because they don't want to babysit them through the winter. And so you can go ahead and get them out of their hands at a good price, put them into your landscape wherever you want them, and bingo, they'll take off.
Ron, I lost a couple of pyramidal arborvitae to the heavy, wet snow we had last year. We were remembering the heavy snowfall we got in October, as a matter of fact, in 2019. So I need to replace them, and I want to replace them with something that will not bend over and almost break under a heavy, wet snow. These are close to the foundation. They faced to the west and southwest. So what are some good potential candidates for that?
Well, I would really, Doug, suggest sticking with the arborvitae because they are dependable. There's a Meyeri arborvitae in this, spelled M-E-Y-R-I, the Meyeri arborvitae, which is a very pyramidal, narrow pyramidal growing arborvitae, very, very attractive and very tough. The thing to do when you do plant any arborvitae, no matter which one you get, would be to get some bamboo stakes and stake them up for the winter month. And that's a good thing to go ahead and follow with our heavy snows that we could very typically get either in the fall here, the first couple of snowfalls, or in the late spring when we don't need to have the snow, like in March, have a heavy wet snow, and that'll end just about any woody plant over that is trying to grow in an upright fashion. So I would strongly encourage you to stay with the arborvitae because they're tough, dependable plants. And it's unfortunate that you lost them last year to that heavy snow, but get some bamboo stakes. They're available probably at most garden centers, privately run garden centers, entrepreneurial garden centers rather than the big box stores. But maybe the big box stores have the bamboo stakes as well. But stake them up, put a couple of them around the main stem, and take some cloth straps or make some cloth straps out of rags, and wrap them around the the main stem as well as around the stakes, and they should be set and ready to go for the winter months.
So I just need to reinforce them.
Absolutely. The thing that's good about this time of the year is that we don't have top growth to contend with. We don't have sudden swings into hot weather. Hopefully, once we get past the winds that we had yesterday, it's not going to be too bad. But what you get is the roots growing. The roots will be actively growing in the soil, no matter what the air temperature is, as long as that soil temperature is at 40 degrees or higher. And it will stay warmer through the month of October without any trouble. And when we get into mid-November, when we start getting some very hard freezes, then depending on the depth that you have them planted, the roots will continue to function in getting the plants established, getting the root systems into the surrounding soil, and they'll be ready to take off and grow beautifully for you next spring without you having to worry about them wilting because of the new growth coming out, and they don't like being moved from the babysitting tree into your backyard where you forgot to water them when you put them in, or you did water them when you put them in, but it got so blasted hot the next couple of days that they wilted anyway. So it's very frustrating to go ahead and try to get things established in the spring. I'm not saying don't plant anything in the spring. It just means, I'm just saying, open up the window, the opportunity to go ahead and do some more planting as we get into the late September, all of October, and but I'm not going to say it for sure. Possibly the ability to go ahead and plant in maybe the first few days of November if we have to.
Any special plants that you are really looking for this time of year, whether because of the deep discounts or just great to add to your garden?
Well, you're going to find some perennials like echinacea, which is very popular because they hold the seeds and the winter birds love those, and they're one of the longest blooming perennials that you can get your hands on. They start blooming in late spring, pretty much through the entire summer. The butterflies love them. They absolutely love them. The pollinating insects like the honeybees love them. Another one is a jopai weed, which is also, I think you'll probably find some of those at some of your local garden centers as well. If you're going to get the standard Joe Pye, give it plenty of room to grow, because they will get to be 7 feet tall and spread out quite a bit. So if they're too big, see if they have a dwarf form available there at the local garden center. They will get to be about 4 feet tall, which would be a much better plant to put in most residential sections, unless you like big, tall, giant blooming plants that will attract all kinds of butterflies. And another one to consider would be Sylvie, which is a very durable plant. And along with that, some ajuga. Sylvie would make a very good spike-type flower. And I think I've seen some in the local garden center that we have here in Fargo, as well as the ajuga, which is an excellent ground cover for semi-shade and full sun locations. So look around and see what's available and get them planted if you possibly can.
Ron, I looked out my garden level, lower level window last week and stared for several minutes at a rabbit, literally a foot and a half away from me, chowing down on my landscaping. And that reminded me that as we get into this cold season, sometimes rabbits and voles, they get hungry too. Is there any kind of a defensive mechanism we can apply to protect our plants during the dormant season?
Well, the best thing to do, it's going to take at least a two-pronged approach, if not more. To get a rabbit repellent, a rabbit and deer repellent, then they have several of them on the market now, which are very good. You need to get out there quite soon, like starting this month. Give them a good coating of that sprayed on. It won't hurt the plant at all, even if it is in full leaf. But give them a good coating of that. And then as we get closer to the winter, you need to put up some kind of a protection. Get some chicken wire or rabbit wire and put it around the plants to keep them from getting in there. Don't get plastic wire, the typical little plastic fences, because the doggone rabbits will eat right through it. They'll bite right through it and get to it. I found that out from experience. And so now I try to put rabbit wire or chicken wire around the plants that I don't want them to get near to. The other thing you have to keep in mind, if you're talking about freshly planted trees that have nice tender bark, remember that our snow does get deep here. And so what might be good at ground level, maybe 6 inches, maybe knee high, I would say probably give them protection up to at least breast height, 4 feet or more, as much as you possibly can, wrapping chicken wire around it or some tape around them. They have tree tape that you can go ahead and put them around them that will discourage and keep rabbits and deer from going ahead and ruining those plants. But if you can in the wintertime, go ahead and give them another blast of the repellent, whatever it happens to be. But typically human nature is that we don't remember to do that in the middle of the winter when it's 20 degrees below zero out there. We say the heck with it. The rabbits go after it anyway.
What about going after those leaves right now? Is it best to be very aggressive or a little bit gentle?
The leaves on the grass should be either picked up either with your mower, or you can do what is called a mulch mowing, where you leave the bag off, and in most cases, the mowers these days have a blade that's at a particular angle that will help to shred the leaves into smaller pieces. Now, that works if you don't have piles of leaves. If you have piles of leaves, you're just going to get shredded leaves in piles out there that I found. So it's a choice. If you like Brussels sprouts, you're going to enjoy eating them every week. If you don't like Brussels sprouts, one serving a year is too much. And it's the same thing with it's the same thing with the leaves. I mean, there are horticulturists, and my good friend Don Kinsler recommends mulch mowing, and more power to him and anybody else that can do it and get away with it. But our leaves just pile up in places, and it's just easier for us to go ahead and leave the bag on the mower, pick it up, put it in the bag, and take it over to recycling. It's just that much easier. However, I would encourage people to leave a light coating of leaves over their garden beds, because that'll help provide a little bit of a snuggly space for the insects that we want around, as well as some of our friendly little critters, including the rabbits, unfortunately. So don't worry about getting your flower beds and your vegetable beds absolutely clean. They will be buried with snow that will give them some kind of protection, and it'll provide a home for some of the more beneficial insects.
What about putting down compost right now? Is that a fall thing or only spring?
No, it's a good thing to do in the fall. Shredded leaves, pine straw, bark chips, compost, any kind of a organic mulch will work. You don't want to overdo it. You don't want to put it on too thick. About 3 inches maybe will do it. Keep them away from the stem of the tree. If it's a young tree, even if it's a large tree, keep them a couple of inches away from that to cut down on varmint character. And the best thing about the mulch now, if you put it on, let the ground freeze first, then put the mulch over it, and that'll keep the ground from going through this freeze-thaw cycle that it typically goes through toward the end of the winter. Many plants can go ahead and survive the winter extremes to only die off in the spring when it warms up and you get the surface of the soil getting liquidy, getting the ice out of it, maybe down 3 inches or so, and then you get another freeze. And that's typical with mums that you have that happening. So if you have mums that you purchased, there's a chance you can go ahead and get them to survive. Even if they're so-called annual mums, they'll be able to survive the location that you put them in if it's well drained. So if you have hard, heavy soil, modify it first with organic matter, peat moss or compost, and then put them in there, and then they'll look beautiful for you this fall up until a hard frost hits them. But then next spring, go ahead and be careful that hopefully if you can keep them from going through a freeze-thaw cycle, they'll be able to survive that because the water will drain down as the soil thaws. So,
Ron, one more question here that you've touched on occasionally, but when is the last time to mow, and how do you know when that time is, and what should you do that last mow of the lawn?
Well, it's one of those things. Right now we're mowing, and we aren't mowing any grass because we have our mower set at the same height that it was all summer long. So we're barely getting any grass blades at all. When there are no longer any leaves on your lawn, which could be any time now, hopefully, I would say any time after the middle of October, late October, early November. Definitely do it before the ground freezes because, believe it or not, it'll injure the turf grass if you go across there with a mower or with the first light freeze. But get out there and drop it down at least one notch lower than what you had it on your mower before. Some people get down too low, and I don't know of anybody's lawn that's putting green smooth. So what you're doing, if you get it too low, you're going to be actually scalping your lawn. You don't want to do that. So you want to drop it down one notch, see if you cut any grass, then that is good enough. You don't need to get it so low that you're scalping your lawn. So I've seen that. People do that in some very fancy houses, and they're going to be in for a bad surprise next spring.
We check in with horticulturist Ron Smith when the growing season is upon us. Thanks, as always, Ron.
Oh, it's a pleasure, and one of these days we'll get to see each other before we get too much older.
Dakota Date Book is next.
Snapping, losing it, going off the deep end. All terms for the moment when we become consumed with fury and become a stranger to ourselves.
This neighbor came up the road in the bulldozer and was pushing over trees, and something just snapped.
The deep logic of irrational rage. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
That's tonight at 8 Central here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Date Book for October 12th. On this date in 1960, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev pounded his shoe on his desk and declared to U.S. citizens, "We will bury you." 1 year later, on October 6, 1961, President Kennedy urged Americans to build bomb shelters to protect them from atomic fallout. A nuclear conflict with Russia would likely mean missiles and planes crossing the Arctic. That made North Dakota an appropriate place for the country to locate nuclear missiles. Field construction began in January of 1962 to house the Minuteman I Intercontinental Ballistic Missile, ICBM, complex. At Minot Air Force Base, Strategic Air Command, SAC, activated the 455th Strategic Missile Wing in November, and in less than a year, the first Minuteman arrived from Hill Air Force Base in Utah. Soon, the North Dakota prairie was spattered with hundreds of missile sites, boasting America's latest technology. During this time, Russian visitors weren't allowed to visit the state, but the missile sites were far from secret. In fact, school kids went on field trips to tour their nearest missile sites. By the next year, 300 Minuteman missiles were fully armed. Interestingly, if the state had decided to split away from the rest of the country, North Dakota would have been the third most powerful nation in the world in terms of atomic weapons. Several years later, the 321st Missile Wing in the Grand Forks Air Force Base was the very first to deploy the more powerful Minuteman II missiles. The Air Force then selected Minot's 91st Strategic Missile Wing to become the first to convert to the Minuteman III in the early 1970s. The Minuteman III tripled the Air Force striking power and was more convincing as a war deterrent. With the Cold War ending in the mid-1990s, the Minuteman missiles were taken off alert. In accordance with the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, the 150 missiles assigned to Grand Forks were to be destroyed and the sites imploded. But the 150 missile sites assigned to Minot were to remain in service. The first missile site to be destroyed was near Langdon on October 6, 1999, where more than 100 spectators watched a piece of military history reduced to a pile of rubble. It was 38 years to the day after Kennedy called on families to build bomb shelters. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Mary Helm. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Some states in this country won't allow mail-in ballots to be processed until Election Day. That could mean workers counting votes for hours on end.
They're sequestered in a room. They can't have any connection to the outside world.
How officials are promising an accurate count. And the latest on Amy Coney Barrett's Supreme Court confirmation hearing. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. After the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Tomorrow on our show, the Virginia Dynasty, Four Presidents and the Creation of the American Nation, is the latest book from historian Lynn Cheney. It focuses on four early presidents, all from Virginia, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and James Monroe. Cheney visits with presidential historian Rick Cullen, a former instructor at the University of Mary. And The Age of Nature is a new PBS series that travels the world to explore innovative ways people are working to restore a natural balance to our planet. We'll hear from filmmaker Amy Young. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.